time. Yeah, making a difference. One cup at a time. So be sure to grab your tea, grab a seat, and tune in to Miss Liz. Tea time, making a difference. One cup at a time.
And welcome to Tea Time. That's right, Miss Liz is back. We were here this morning at 10, and we had the incredible Audrey Bourbon here sharing on the Holocaust. Now I have the incredible Richard Sparks here, and we're going to liven it up with a little bit of comedy. That's right, we're going to take you down a little twist. So I want to get the disclaimer going. I'm going to do a little bit of Richard's bio, and then we're going to get Richard in here, and we're going to spill a different kind of cup of tea with all of you guys this afternoon. So grab your tea, grab your coffee, grab your glass of wine, grab your beer. You do not have to drink tea on Tea Time with Miss Liz. If you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, go and check that out. Give that a quick subscribe. Ring that little doorbell, because then you get notified for all these cool, incredible tea times that are coming around from all over the globe. So now let's get started. So the disclaimer for Miss Liz's Tea Time live show. Miss Liz, myself, is going live using StreamYard. Before leaving a comment, please grant StreamYard permission to see your name at StreamYard.com. Please be advised that the content brought forward for any Tea Time show hosted by myself, Miss Liz, is always brought forward in good faith. However, may bring forth dialogues and opinions that are not representative of my platform. The facts and information are perceived to be accurate at the given time of airing. All Tea Time guests and audience participants are responsible for using their good judgment in taking any action that may relate to the discussion. The content brought forward may include discussion for some where they may be emotionally at risk. It is significant to know that this show is engaging in discussion forums only to offer inspire awareness and connection and is not providing therapeutic advice. If you have any questions about the disclaimer or the panelist discussion, you may freely contact me, Miss Liz, through my email at bookingmissliz@gmail.com. Moving forward, should you choose to voluntarily participate in today's show in any aspect, I myself, Miss Liz, welcomes you. And should you decide that the show is not made for you at this time, I respect those wishes and we'll see you at a later show at a later date and time. And again, all tea times this year in 2023 are done on Thursday, 10, 3, and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Three new TEAs each and every Thursday. If you see a tea time that's not on a Thursday, it's a rescheduled tea time or it's a surprise guest that wants to come back for a second cup of tea with Miss Liz. So now let me give you a little bit on Richard. Who is Richard? Well, Richard Sparks is... I'm losing. Everything is all over, Miss Liz. Focus. Richard Sparks' writing credentials spans the gamut of entertainment world from films and TV and books through lyrics for operas. These include iconic shows like Not the 9 O'Clock News, BBC TV, and The Secret Policeman Ball, BBC TV, performed by Roland Atkinson and directed by John Cleese. Books he has written includes the biography of the music producer Milt Oaken, along with Cheryl Blaine. Richard was born in England and now lives in Los Angeles, writing both fantasy novels and opera lyrics, both original and translation of classic work. Richard Sparks is an English-born comedian writer, lyric liberalist, author, and director now living in Los Angeles. He has written extensively for television, film, radio, and the stage, as well as theaters and the opera. His opera, Liberty, I think I'm saying it right, I'm not sure, I'll get Richard to say it, includes original works mostly commissioned by the Los Angeles Opera and translated adaptions of classic opera. To get Richard's full bio, we're going to get you to check out Miss Liz's Facebook page. I'm going to get Richard in here and I'm going to sip on my tea. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Liz. How are you?
I am good. Was I saying that word right? I you know, sometimes my tongue gets all twisted.
Libretti, libretto. It just means little book in Italian. It's like the book of a musical, but a libretto is usually all sung. A musical, sing and then speak and then sing and then speak.
Oh, so well, I just learned something. So, Richard, I'm going to start off how I start off all my tea times. So who is Richard as a little guy and who is Richard now?
Well, it's a little guy. Well, I was there's a little guy in my books. That's the name of a dog that they pick up and becomes part of the team. Who was a perfectly normal English kid living in a small village on the outskirts of Cheltenham, which is a town in the west of England, Gloucestershire. Very nice. We were right on the edge of the green belt, so it's we could run in, off into the woods with bare feet and play. My parents were school teachers. My father was a schoolmaster at Cheltenham College. And then when he moved on from that, he and my mother ran Berkhamsted School in Cheltenham, which is a school that takes children from the ages of three, boys up to eight and girls up to 11 or 12, before sending them on to their secondary schools. I was actually there myself before I went off to boarding school. I went to boarding school at eight, the Dragon School in Oxford, absolutely loved it. Then on to another public school. And then I went to Oxford University, having had a bit of an adventure between leaving school and going up there, in that I hitchhiked across Canada at the age of 18 in March, when it was pretty nippy. Had a contact in Calgary, got a job on the magnetic North Pole, an island called Prince Patrick Island.
Oh.
We're on an oil exploration crew. So I was hauling cables around in the snow and getting very cold, but that was just great fun. And all the ice, we were standing on ice, drilling holes through ice and letting off dynamite. And all that ice has melted in my lifetime. It was 35 foot thick in places. Earned enough money at that to buy a 1955 Ford station wagon up in Great Falls, Montana, and drove to Mexico. then all the way across the States to California, which I loved. The first moment I saw Los Angeles, I thought, I'm coming back here. Went on to Hawaii. And Hawaii was a shock, because at the airport, there were a lot of kids my age, all in khaki drab, all looking really scared, going off to Vietnam. And I went over to them. You know, I was trying to become a hippie and grow long hair. They were, had their head shaved, and I just chatted to some of them, and they were so just absolutely lost. It was really a shocking experience. Then got back to England, went to Oxford University, started writing comedy sketches there with my roommate originally. I just bumped into him one day and said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to audition for a review." And I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "It's comedy sketches. You know, you write funny stuff," because I used to leave him funny notes. Come along. So I went, and the director made me audition for it. I didn't want to be in it. I'm not an actor. I ended up later doing some comedy shows with my partner. But so I had to go outside the room, come back in. It's an orchard, and you pick an apple off a tree, and there's a maggot in it. I said, all right. And I did a sort of pathetic effort at it. And they said, "Well, we'll let you know. But apparently you write stuff," Peter said. "So come along to the first meeting." I went to the first meeting. One of the people there, Mel Smith, later went on to become a big TV star. Now, sadly, no longer with us, on Not 9 o'clock News. And he was in The Princess Bride, for example.
Oh, my goodness. That was the first movie I ever went and watched in a theater.
He was the albino with the long hair.
Oh,
He was a great friend of mine and a heroic gambler. His father was a bookmaker in London, legal, of course. I remember one night we were in Edinburgh doing the Edinburgh Festival, and Mel said, "Richard, you got a car? Come on. We're driving down to York to see the Gold Cup." I said, "Oh, all right." So We piled into my mum's Triumph, which I had borrowed for the duration of the Edinburgh Festival. I drove down to York races. We slept in the car park of the race course. And we were there to watch a very famous horse called Brigadier Gerard, who we were madly devoted to, big fans, unbeaten. And Mel, because I'd done the driving, he had to sleep in the front seat. And Mel was considerably bigger than I was. So waking up in the morning and seeing him wrapped around the gear stick was fun. And that was the only day that Brigadier Gerard ever lost. He promptly retired. He was beaten by the Derby winner, for heaven's sake. He was the heavy favourite. Mel lost every penny he had. I had managed to save enough to pay for petrol to get us back to Edinburgh. Getting back to the story. So we had the first meeting of the review, and everyone's meeting and being friendly. And the director said, does anyone have any material or sketches? And nobody did. But I'd taken time to write. I said, well, I have. He said, what is it? And I said, well, I've written a silly history of English, of the history of drama from Greek tragedy through to today. I said, oh, sounds good. So I started reading it. They all started laughing. And then they said, well, that's great. There's our show. Well, and they all chipped in other things, other sketches, of course, because I'd only had a couple of days to write, you know, which was probably about 20 or 30 minutes of material. And that was fun. I think they made me be in the show. I can't remember. When we got to Edinburgh, I had to be in the show because places were needed to be filled up. And Mel directed a student production of Much Ado About Nothing with the film star Lisa Eichhorn playing Beatrice before she went on to do Yanks with Richard Gere. And she was Mel's girlfriend at the time. And I had to be in that. And I had to sing. It's horrible. Anyway, it was great fun. And at the same time up there, we met the Cambridge crew, which was Douglas Adams, Griff Rhys-Jones, who later became Mel Smith's double act partner in Not the 9 o'clock News and later. And Douglas became a great friend. We had the same agent in London. He was wonderful, much missed. So that's me, young me up to age mid-20s. Then I actually had a job in TV for a couple of years, but hated every minute of it. I've always wanted to just be self-employed writer, and sometimes several years I've been a self-unemployed writer, you know, calling up the bank manager and saying, sorry, I haven't got any money, can I? I had one good year when I was sent to New Zealand to make a series for Portman Productions in England. I got there. I was meant to write 8 scripts and script edit the rest. The writer was probably about 50 and a drunk. He'd written a book that it was based on. And the first meeting I had with him, 10:30 in the morning, he handed me a scotch this size. And I thought, oh, okay. And he had no idea how to write scripts. And the first script he wrote, the first 4 pages were people saying, hello, how have you been since you were last here in New Zealand? What's happened to you? You know, it was an adventure series. You had to get on with it. So I ended up writing 23 scripts in 3 months. The producer wrote the other 3. Wow. And then I flew back to London once we got ahead of filming. And basically for the next year, I was rebuilding the house I'd bought just before I left in South London, which I loved. In those days, I got paid really well by standards of the time to make that series. Still had to have a mortgage, of course, but so that really stopped me writing for a while because I was knackered. But then Not the 9 o'clock News was happening at the same time. So John Lloyd, the producer of that, hired me to be part of the team. I'm not very good at satire, which is what it was. It's not where I naturally fit. In fact, I remember right at the beginning when he was telling me about it, I said, well, what sort of show is it going to be? And he said, well, it's going to be the news irreverently from taking the mickey out of everything. And I said, oh, you're going back to the old satire days, are you? Why don't we follow on from what Python's done? I mean, that's... And he said, are you kidding? We're not nearly as good as them. No, not going near that. So he was absolutely right. Python zigged and John and not the 9 o'clock News zagged. Very, very popular because there were only 4 channels and the other ones were all grown up. And while the parents were watching the news at 9 o'clock, the kids and the young were watching Not the 9 o'clock News. And Griff was saying only the other day to someone, a friend of ours, So many people come up to me now and say, "You're my grandfather's favorite comedian." He grew up watching you. Griff's what, 70? Very, very lovely man. So yeah, and then I got over to New America in 92. I was hired by Columbia Pictures Television to work with Blake Hunter and Marty Cohan, who had created Who's the Boss. So I was kind of involved with the last year of that. I wasn't part of the writing team for that. I was writing a new a pilot for a new series with them, which in the end didn't happen, but that was a great start and broke me over here to some extent. And I was lucky that my wife's father and mother lived here, so we moved into their garage, and our daughter went to school here, and we eventually bought our own house here where I am now. And and then eventually we got on to New Rock, New Roll, having done operas and everything.
Yeah, I want to get into that with you, Richard, during the show. But how old were you when you started writing the scripts?
Oh, what, scripts for TV?
Yeah, the comedy scripts.
Like, oh, 21, 22. As soon as I left university, I got a job at Welsh Television. Well, I spent the first 9 months flat sharing with Paul Barry, who's basically the, I don't know, the, what do you call him? Not the Walter Cronkite of Australia, but the Rachel Maddow of Australia, should we call him. He has a show, I don't know, it's an arts program. Paul's written many books, and he was at my university, my college, on the same corridor as me, and a great, great friend. So he and I shared a flat with another friend, and he was already a private secretary to a minister in the government, and I was working as a very, very incompetent minicab driver, losing £10 a week because I just wanted to write. So eventually I managed to get a job at Welsh Television. I followed advertisements, and they hired me to write what they call continuity, things the announcers say between programs and to make trailers. And while I was there, a producer I was talking to, so he said, "Oh, you write stuff. We're doing a new show. Would you like to write some scripts for it?" I said, "Yes, please." And it was the first English language children's show that they'd done on Welsh independent television, HTV it's called. And so I was writing gags for a lump of coal and a haystack and a fisherman with a big nose. It was called Cambry Antics, not my title. But that, by the time I got to London, after I left HTV, I had, you know, credits for six shows under my belt. So when I went to the agent that somebody recommended me to, I was able to say, down in Wales, I've got some experience as well as the comedy. So she took me on. And she had just had a boutique agency, Jill Foster, her name was. So Douglas was one of them, Douglas Adams, Gail Renard, who later was twice head of the British Writers Guild and is very, very good comedy writer and book writer. Some of the Pythons, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, they both left to go to the rest, join the other Pythons. Graham Chapman stayed with Jill until he died. Tim Brooke Taylor was a British radio and TV star. Very, very nice man. So there's only about 25 of us.
Richard, do you know the writers of Mrs. Brown?
I do not. No, I don't really know the English TV world anymore. I've been living over here for so long. You sort of stop, if you write scripts for TV, you sort of stop watching it really, because it's like work. You see TV and it's like work. but actually, on that point, I really had a reversal quite recently, because I had a meeting with Jerry O'Hara when I was young. He was probably mid-50s, and he was one of the original writers on The Avengers. And so a hero of mine, and my agent hooked me up with him. We had a nice meeting. And he said, the trouble with writers these days, the young writers, they've grown up watching television. They've never lived. You know, he'd been in the army and stuff, maybe. I don't know if he'd been in the war, but certainly national service. He'd seen the world. And he said, they've just no television and nothing else. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. And then last year or the year before, my wife, you know, she makes me watch television. She said, this one you've got to see. Come on, see it. And it was the series Wednesday that Tim Burton put together. And I absolutely loved it. I watched one night, and then one the next night, and the next day was Saturday, so you binge watched the lot before breakfast. And I just thought Jerry was wrong, because the kids who write these, well, they're probably young writers, who are writing these scripts, they're so good because they've been exposed their entire life to great television. They've had a masterclass for 20, 30 years watching great TV, so it comes completely natural to them. I was so impressed with that series. It was great. I don't like horror, but I love the sort of gothic feel of that. And I don't like gory stuff that, you know, with there's enough crap in my head without those pictures of blood and limbs and stuff.
But I'm the same way. I'd rather watch a good comedy or, you know, just laugh. Life is so serious, right? Just have some fun.
That's a great example of it. Wednesday is such fun amid the tension and the story. And that's what I do in New Rock, New Roll, and the three sequels I've written so far, because comedy and fantasy and adventure all fit together. Comedy's not nice people telling jokes. That's as I say, that's a dinner party. Comedy is fear and pain and misery and things going wrong and disasters and upsets and miscommunications and people falling into puddles. I mean, what good adventure doesn't have that? So it's a natural fit.
Well, it's like a clown, right? Everyone laughs at a clown. Well, they're falling. They're failing all the time, right?
Yeah, well, that the pratfalls. I mean, you look at Rowan Atkinson, who I was lucky enough to work with before he was Rowan Atkinson, even when he was totally unknown. He did my script, my sketch in The Secret Policeman's Ball. And he's just utterly brilliant. His physical comedy is extraordinary. Yeah. Mr. Bean, you know.
I like to watch a lot of UK programs because my uncle comes from the UK. So
really?
Yeah. So I just like the humor. I find the humor is different than the American humor.
It is. It's both. But I mean, I love, you know, I was lucky enough to meet Robin Williams, and another great hero of mine, because I was able to say to him at a little club where he'd performed, you know, Peter Cook, who I knew, says, "You're really great. Now you're going to perform tonight." He said, "Oh, well, I just did." So this was 1984, the Olympics, at the Improv. He said, "But well, look, you know, for a friend of me, just don't tell anyone. But I'm doing it again tomorrow night." He was trying out new stuff. I think he just ad-libbed it every night. So of course, I told everyone in town I knew, which was about two people. So my wife and I and our friends went, and it was a classic evening. It was one of these poor girl comedians dying the death on stage. And this is the day when comedians weren't quite as slick and trained as they are now. And she was sort of standing there at a microphone saying, "So, anyone here from the Valley?" You know, that kind of thing. And so my heart bled for her. And then the audience was only about 20 people in there shifting around. And then Bud Friedman came up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I've got a treat for you. Robin Williams." And the whole room went, what? You know, we already... And he came out with no microphone, and he did the Olympics, which was just about to happen. Running around the audience, he did the Pakistani baseball and hubcap stealing team, charging around from first base to second base to third base, stealing bases, throwing things in, doing silly voices. And, you know, I was in pain laughing so much. Absolutely brilliant. So English humor. I mean, look at Mel Brooks, who Carl Reiner lived a couple of blocks from here. I knew Carl pretty well, his family friends, and met Mel a few times. I mean, do listen to his biography that he reads for himself, All About Me. Brilliant. I could go on forever about Americans. My father was in the Second World War as an officer in the Gurkhas, and he was in North Africa burning secret papers as Rommel was coming across. You know, he was a junior lieutenant. And he said at night, he and the exhausted soldiers, you know, squaddies, privates as well as officers, would go to a flea pit cinema in a cellar and watch the Marx Brothers. And just the joy that Groucho and co brought to him. And when I told him I was marrying an American, when I told him I was marrying an American, he said, "Well, I suppose the country that gave us Louis Armstrong and Groucho Marx can't be all bad." He's a lovely man.
So Richard, is that where you got your comedy side from? Is your father?
He was very funny. Yes, he used to do good stories and good jokes. And I mean, he took me to see Marx Brothers Go West. I think it was the first live film I'd ever seen. And I fell off my chair and rolled on the floor in the cinema, Pools Coliseum in Cheltenham. And we went to London. I saw Spike Milligan live in Son of Oblomov, which was absolutely extraordinary because he just went off script all the time. And there was a scene going on, and he'd just go off and do something else, and the other poor actors trying to keep up or go do something else. And you could see them all just corpsing away on stage. It was just, the audience was in hysterics. One time he left the stage and he noticed a pretty girl in the box by the side. Oh, hello, madam. Walked off. And then the other actors are doing their scene. And then Spike's little face peeked around the corner of the stage. And then his eyebrows waggled and he went back again. And then leaving the poor actors just bucketing with laughter. And the house was just, everyone, when people are roaring at different times, that's when they.
You keep everybody engaged, right? When you're doing all of the off scripts as well. Sometimes sometimes when you write the scripts, sometimes the actors themselves kind of twist it, right? They put their little kick in there.
I got to give proposition to my worst enemy at school, his own description, my second boarding school, because he was very funny. I mean, he was extremely intelligent, but he was slightly in the wrong class of he should have been the top academic stream, and he was, and I was, and I was half his size as well. So he'd pick on everybody, but he used to particularly like taunting me, and he was very funny. And I thought, that's what I want to be. I want to do that. So I sort of made myself figure out how to do it. And years later, one of my very best friends, who's best man at my wedding, said he'd met this guy, Will, who had a wonderful drawly voice. He said, William, I gather you were Richard's worst enemy at school. And Will said, I wasn't Richard's worst enemy. I was everybody's. I've met him since, and he's delightful. You know, I think just adolescent boys are vile to each other if they can be, and they grow out of it. So props to the enemies and to the friends.
So, Richard, what has it taught you about yourself working with all these incredible people?
About me?
About you?
I'm doing what I love. I know it's hard. I'm not, you know, I'm now in the early stages of book 5 of the New Rock series. And looking back, you know, book 3 and book 4 and book 2 and book 1 were all make perfect sense. But I remember now, looking forward, you get, there's the stages where you're lost, you're confused, you know where you're going. I know how it's going to land. I don't know how I'm going to get there through the next 400 pages, because I don't need to. I need to let it tell me. It's not always easy, but I'm doing what I love. And it's frustrating when you can't get your nose over the parapet, or the job doesn't happen, or the TV series doesn't come off, or, you know, I felt like a failure for a long time, even though I was doing a lot of work, because it was all, it was clearly leading up to something. When I got over that, and I've been lucky enough to do, you know, work with many great people, from Isabel Allende and Placido Domingo to Dom DeLuise and Eric Idle and the Pythons, even on Secret, and Rowan Atkinson.
So, Richard, what got you out of comedy and into science fiction?
I don't think I've ever left comedy behind. It's not science fiction, it's fantasy. Well, it grew out of my love of online gaming. I found out about massively multiplayer online role-playing games about 15 years ago. Disappeared down the rabbit hole. My wife goes to bed. I usually cook dinner at night and we go out. And she goes to bed early and gets up very early. She's a lark. She's an artist, works all the time. We both work all the time. And I stay up late and I was just gaming a lot. And there were people in my headphones all over the world, and we'd laughing away with each other and going off and raiding other factions, if you're playing player versus player, or you can just play against the environment, player versus environment. And one night I was just thinking, my main avatar character that I'd built and designed was a heroic young battle mage, a healer who could also deal damages and with a magic staff. And I just thought, what would it really be like to actually be that guy in that amazing world? Because the developers and designers have created these extraordinary environments for us to go and explore and play in. And you don't have to do combat. You can just build a house or make friends or have a tea party. Just look around and just want, they're extraordinary environments. Well, there was only way to find out, and that was to write it. So I liken it to Wile E. Coyote getting an anvil dropping on his head one day. It just clanged onto my head one summer morning nearly 5 years ago. I started writing the next day and didn't stop. The first book took mere 2 months. I mean, it's had a lot of work with editors since, and they've been really, really helpful. And I was just thinking of self-publishing it because that's what people can do these days. And then I thought, well, I've got a very good New York literary agent. Let's send it to her and see what she thinks. So I did. And then you wait for agents to read things because they're busy. So I got on with the sequel because I wanted to find out what happened next. And so when she called up, it was one of those phone calls, the best phone call of my life, really. So I had to pull over. I was driving back from playing music with my friend stroke teacher. I play the 5-string banjo and go off once a week and hack away with an expert. I had to pull over and she said, this is exactly what people want. It's escapism, it's fun, it's lighthearted, it's got comic elements, it's adventure. Don't even think of self-publishing it. I said, oh, okay, well, I'm writing a sequel. She said, oh, great, 3-book deal. And I went, oh, it's 3 now, is it? Anyway, it's actually 4. And it's one follows, it's not a trilogy. Although by the end of book 4, there is a fairly satisfying ending to some emotional arc. But then I'm finding out what happens next. So I've just been keeping on at it. Julia got it accepted at Kazakh Science Fiction and Fantasy, a very good young imprint of Arc Manor Publishing, run by a very go-ahead publisher. And I'm thrilled to be with them, but one reason is they've given me a fantastic editor. She's called Leslie Robin. She's quite well known in fantasy circles. And she is their executive editor. And she just is so good. I can't tell you. We really punched it up. And she encouraged me to do more. She said, look, this artifact you've got here, you've already done it. Do you realize what you've done? This is a character. I want more of it. The relationship between artifact and handler, owner. Let's have more of it. So I thought, well, that's a good idea. You don't get insights like that from editors all the time.
Well, and so, it's always nice to get that feedback, right?
Yeah.
And those pulls on the strings. Come on, give me more, dig deeper. Yeah,
absolutely. It's just, it's extraordinary. Editing is where you get the gold. I've done more script editing than I can shake a stick at. And I used in London to fix scripts for producers who didn't have time to get back. Sometimes the writer would write a whole season. Whereas here in America, you have a room. I've done that myself in England. I've written every script in a series. And that's exhausting. And the writer doesn't often have time to go in and do the rewrites that are needed. So a producer would send it to me to punch up. And then he would sort of present it to the writer as if he'd done it. Because I didn't want my name all over it. It wasn't my work. I didn't want to offend a fellow writer. I was just happy to be getting a wage. So you learn a lot that way. Yeah. I would work with the producer as my script editor, and I'd work with the writer's script as a script editor. When I was writing The Famous Five with Gail Renard as my writing partner, she and I script edited each other's. And you learn very fast. I mean, I can tell you the story of my very first script, if you like, which is quite
sure,
quite
absolutely. I'm enjoying this conversation, and my listeners are enjoying it as well, because you're giving a lot of information, right? Because a lot of people, they look at directing and films and theater as easy work. There's so much that goes on in the back scene that no one knows about.
Well, it's like we've had a year since Kazakh signed me before publication, which is the 12th of December, 12th of next month. And in that time, we've done the 90% of the work that you don't see underwater. And the tip of the iceberg is what you see, all the preparation of the website, the PR, the editing, the designing of the cover. It's hard work, but it's fantastically exciting work. Just do what you love. The mistake that I made attempting to write fiction before was I wrote the sort of books I didn't want to read, where I read the sort of books I didn't want to write. And so they were well written, but anyone could have written them. And so I'm really, really pleased none of them got published, because this is where I belong with New Rock, New Rock, New Role. It's R-O-L-E, role-playing games. Get it?
I like the title. I like it. Like, well, New Rock, New Role. Like, it's got like a catch to it. You could actually almost write like a little jingle to it.
Well, Brian O'Donoghue's written some fantastic music for it, which you can hear at the top of the audio sample. If you go to New Rock, New Roll, richardsparks.com, we've got a holding page up at the moment. We had a bit of a misadventure with our website designers, who turned out to be blackmailers and scammers. So we're having very convenient just 2 weeks before publication. Anyway, so we've fired them and got a reputable company who've put up a actually very beautiful holding page. And there you can get a free chapter for your computer or EPUB, you know, Kindle, Nook, iPad, or a free audio sample of me reading a chapter that usually gets some laughs when I read it at conventions. So what was I saying before that?
We got into the bad website and bad.
Well, hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work, but just write what you love. Don't waste time writing things you think I ought to write this because that's what people are publishing now, or I've got to get some book published. Well, actually, that's what Hilary Mantel did, and she's brilliant. So she wrote a book just to get published and then went back to the historical fiction that she wanted to write. She wanted to find a good book about the French Revolution, historical fiction, and couldn't find one. Wrote it herself, couldn't get it published, so wrote something to launch it. So it's different for every writer. There is no one set path. But the truth is you have to do it for yourself in the end. No one's going to do it for you. And you can, you know, just keep on keeping on, but really find what you want to do, and what you love, and don't worry about what's out there, because if you build it, they will come. If it's any good, they'll like it.
That's what my grandma tells me all the time. She used to tell me, just do it. Just put it out there and serve the tea. So, Richard, I want to get into the tea because time is just flying by. We're just having a good old ball time here. So if I give you the letters TEA, what words would you give me today?
Ah, yes. Well, you gave me a little bit of head start to work on this. So my tea is a quotation from Sir Arnold Bax, a British conductor and composer in the interwar years, who said, "Tea, try everything in life once except incest and folk dancing."
Well, I cannot say I've never had that cup of tea at this table.
Well, and then I tell, as I told you, I play 5-string banjo, and I told that to friends of mine who play in old-timey bands, and they play for folk dancing. They said, "Folk dancing is great. What's he talking about, stupid man?" So anyway, it's such a great quote.
Can you share it again for me, Richard?
Try everything in life once except incest and folk dancing.
I like it.
Sir Arnold Bax of Happy Memory. My E is it's another quote, actually, to go with it. This is easy. It's an American, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm."
Oh, I like that.
It's brilliant. And so my E is enthusiasm, and my A is adventure. I love adventures. I love adventure stories. I've had adventures going to the North Pole when I was 18, magnetic North Pole, backpacking in Papua New Guinea with my wife on our honeymoon. Now those sort of rather more butch adventures are behind us. But the thing about gaming online, you can sit down, put your headphones on, and go anywhere in the world, the galaxy, back in time, to these incredible environments, and have your adventures from the comfort of your own home. There's a Shirley Curtis, I think her name is, on YouTube, Skyrim Granny. She's 86, and she has 1.3 million followers who watch her playing a video game. Skyrim Granny. So older people are getting into gaming. I thought, and I use this in the book, actually, I thought all gamers were young when I signed on. And then one day in guild chat, you join guilds because, you know, to buy and sell things and make friends, mainly for trading. One day the guild master put in chat, "I'm turning 85 next week and I want to retire. Does anyone want to take over running the guild?" And she was a really good guild master. I don't, running a guild is far too much hard work, but 85, whoa, I thought, yeah, they're not us, just all kids with button pressing. And the role-playing games are great fun. I don't like the first-person shooter genre myself. Those seem to be target practice, and they're also rather too gory for my taste. I like the atmosphere and the magic and the mystery. And funnily enough, having come out of that into writing novels, you can do far more in narrative writing than you can in a game. Because in a game, there are only two kinds of quests, whether you're in outer space, the Stone Age, a magic world, and those quests are go and kill something or go and fetch something. We call them kill or FedEx. But in a book, my book is what the hell is the quest? What's happened to these guys? Why this guy? Why is this happening? Who's done this to him? And what does he have to... And the actual main quest only reveals itself after a couple of hundred pages, because he goes through the learning and the training and the adventures, and then, oh, I think the answer might lie that way. Slowly reveals itself. You can't do that in a game, because those are already written by the developers. And they all say, and this is not to be disparaging to my fellow writers, but all the developers I've talked to say they are the weak link, not the writers, the writing, because of the form of role-playing games. They have to be closed up, the quests. There has to be answers to them. And even if there's a fiendish puzzle, well, people get bored, just Google the answer. You can't do that in a book. If you're going with Sherlock Holmes through a mystery, you've got to go through it with him or with any detective and try and find out what's going on and what's happening. And the unfolding of narrative is way, way superior to the unfolding of a video game. You know what they say, that the pictures on radio are better than on television? Whatever's in your own head. But I just, the only trouble is I've been writing these books flat out now and loving it, and I hardly have time to log on and play any games anymore. But I think maybe I've found my bliss, so I'll take that as a win.
So, Richard, what was your first video game that you played? Because I'm curious.
The first one that I played... The first one I really remember being great was Dragon Age, the original Dragon Age, which must be about 15 years. There was a sequel to it. Then I discovered, was it Oblivion, which is one of the Elder Scrolls games. I love Mass Effect, was an outer space game that I liked. That was like the Game of Thrones TV series. It had just the most wretched ending that just destroyed all the efforts that they'd put into it before, saying, oh, none of this matters. I was very worried when they made Game of Thrones into a show, because the books are brilliant and I loved them. But actually, the show is fantastic until the final season, when they'd left George Martin's material behind, and they're not as good writers as he is. They just blew the ending so badly that we were all very cross with them.
So that explains why the ending is a little different. They changed the writers.
No, they were the same writers, the showrunners. And they had the same writing, very good writers, but they didn't get it right. I mean, everyone knows it. The ending if you're going to have Daenerys go mad, and she's inherited her madness from the Mad King and all that sort of stuff, lay the pipe. You can't, if you want to pay off like that, you have to set it up better. You can't have her suddenly go bonkers and Tyrion go, no, no, please don't go mad suddenly. It just doesn't work. That's not the person we've been looking at for 10 seasons and madly falling in love with and supporting and hoping that she wins. And she turns into something completely... You can't turn on a dime like that and expect us to follow along. And that's just awful writing. And, I've done enough awful writing to know it myself when I see it. Compare that with the writing on Wednesday, the plotting in that. And you'll see there's night and day difference. And there's so many good writers in Hollywood. It was really a surprise.
But so anyway. Richard, do you feel like when a series goes too long, sometimes the writing starts to die?
Oh, yeah. Happens all the time. The rule in television is if it works, do it again. In the sitcom, you try and leave it more or less where you started so that you can do it again the following week. But after a bit, it gets tired. Any idea gets tired. I mean, look at Happy Days. Jumping the shark has now become slang for doing something too silly that's outside the range of the show, outside the feel of the show, because they're just trying to breathe life into a corpse at that stage. It used to be pressure on shows to make 10 seasons, so they then go to syndication, for a large amount of money. And I think in the streaming age, that's slightly different. For example, you don't have to have seasons of 26 now. You can have a season of 8 1-hours or 14 half-hours, depending on what the producers and the broadcasters settle on.
See, and that's what I want my listeners and audience to understand is all the hidden gems that are in behind a production, right? There's so many parts and puzzle pieces that people just don't get, that there's so much under that ice, right? And you talked about this right at the beginning when you were saying that as a little boy, you went on, worked in the North Pole, or where was it?
I was 18.
Prince Patrick.
Yeah, Prince Patrick Island. Yes, we flew from Calgary to Yellowknife to Resolute Bay. And after Resolute, it was a DC-4, so the seats were just sort of basically canvas. And I, for the first time in my life, I heard some really colourful language that these Canadians were using. They were all young kids, but they were mostly in their 20s. And someone came on and said, you better put your Arctic clothes on now because we're going to land. So we got into these clothes we were completely unused to wearing, landed on this ice runway. The door flew open and a large Australian, looking like in one big one piece, like a massive blue polar bear, came in with him, a blast of the coldest air you've ever felt. And we got out and ran. And of course, having been at boarding school, as my friend who came with me from Montreal, I'd never met him until we were on the flight with a mutual friend. We hitchhiked across Canada together and he got a job on the same crew. And he and I had both been at separate boarding schools, so we knew how to look after ourselves. And we went and found a hut, and all the Canadians were standing around going, oh, what do we do? It's cold. Well, we'll go and get the heater. So there's a heater. We went outside, found an oil drum, rolled it up, put the pump in, went back inside, lit it. it's great. It was really good fun. And if you didn't survive the 60-day contract, you had to pay your own flight back to Calgary. Oh. And three of them didn't, including the butcher's guy of the lot who had one of those chest expanders. He's always doing that. He lasted a week. Moose. He was homesick. But it's great. Yeah. A lot of stuff. We were talking about preparation and icebergs, weren't we?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just like the field of directing and all of that. It's like digging into the ice, right? It's the different layers. There's so much behind
it. Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's so important. I've directed quite a lot of things. And any director, whether you've got talent or not, can do the following two things. Prepare and run a happy ship. Now, many directors don't know how to direct actors, many film directors, which is a shame. So actors have to learn how to direct themselves. I studied at Beverly Hills Playhouse, how to direct actors for several years with, you know, Oscar-winning actors in the masterclass every Saturday morning, and great teachers, Milton Katsalas and Jeffrey Tambor, who went on to have a very good acting career. Gloria Gifford, who has her own conservatory now, and learned a lot. Learned a great deal. And, you know, to prepare a script takes time. Even if I've written a script of my own, I can only prepare the left-hand side of the page, maybe five or six pages a day, because it's, you know, this is what it says. What does it mean? How are we going to do it? If the actor comes to me and says, what's going on here? What does this line mean? What's going underneath it? I need to know. And if they've got a better idea, oh, great. Yeah, but at least we've got a start. Yeah. And run a happy ship. And there are, you know, there was some guy in class came back with a story from a major picture he'd been in, telling about how the director had yelled when somebody flubbed someone with one line flubbed a camera move. Get me someone who can act. Get this clown off my set. Screaming in front of us. You don't do that. Yeah. These are your fellow professionals. So run a happy ship. It's not that difficult. Directing can be exhausting. And the last big thing I directed was the opera Dulce Rosa, that was Lee Holdridge wrote the music. It was from a story by Isabel Allende that I chose, and I wrote the libretto and directed it. And Placido Domingo was the conductor at the LA Opera. So it's a really big deal. And after a bit, I learned from the stage manager the protocols of opera directing. So I get the room as the director, and the chorus members all have, you know, their names on in front of them. So I try to remember them all, but it's difficult. And you're working with, and they've done thousands of operas between them. And the singers are coming from all over the world. Luckily, this was a new piece, so they didn't know their parts. And after a bit, there's a certain point where you get to what's called the Sitzprobe, where they're sitting down on stage with the orchestra. just about that stage, it's not my room anymore. It's the conductor's room. And I'm at the back, and if I got notes, I'm lucky to get a moment to talk to the singers because it's his room. And there's union rules about who can do what and where and when. That was a wonderful experience. So yeah, it's just prepare. It's so important, and anyone can do it.
And this is what we need, right? We need the information out there. We need to educate. You know, so many people just think like, boom, lights, camera, action, and that's all there is to it. And right. I so want people to understand there's so much little nuggets that happen, little keys, little puzzle pieces that all work together, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I did a show, a small play in London called The Crimson Lizard years ago, which is basically a two-hour sketch. And the I realized after three persons in it, three-person play, and the lead actor, Gavin Richards, is, you know, without a doubt, the most talented actor I've ever worked with. I mean, Rowan Atkinson, I didn't really work with him. I just wrote the sketch that he did. So I was source material. But Gavin was an experienced director, and he did the lead part, in which he found five completely different characters to play in this one part. And I just found myself backing off to the back of the room and letting him get on with it, and watching the other two actors thinking, we're going to have to work to keep up with this guy. And he, without him, you know, that's where I learned what actors can bring to your show. So you don't, if you don't go with a fixed idea of it has to be like this, you go in with what the possibilities are. You have some idea, but when something like that happens to you, it's a real eye-opener. It was just, I go, oh, thank God, they can do that. They can make this happen to my writing. It was just, and that, again, that show, when it was on, it was a 100-seat theater. And I remember there was a row of my friends in front of me, and they were all doing this rocking backwards and forwards at different times, laughing, because Gavin was, you know, he could just stand there and do nothing. And it was heaven. And this great friend of mine I've met, Jonathan Shallett, who's head of Intertalent in London, one of the most biggest managers and agents in London. And I met him because he came every night to this little pub in South London, and he was in the bar. And I said, oh, you again? He said, yeah, I love it. And we became mates. We've been friends ever since. He must have seen it 20 times in its 3-week run.
Wow. So Richard, we're almost at the end. See, we're just having a blast. We're just rolling and spilling this tea like no tomorrow. So Richard, I want to get into the new rock, new role. So it's coming out December 12th, correct?
And the audiobook's coming out a week later on Blackstone on the 19th. Do you want me to tell you the setup?
Sure. Give us a little roll on that.
Oh, well, the narrator is basically based on me and my father put together. He's a retired English school teacher living alone in his bungalow in a little village in England, where he spends his entire life, he's a widower, spends his entire life online, where life is richer and more exciting, gaming. And his two particular buddies are Creaster, who's the dual-wielding sword-dancing avatar of an Asian-American girl with her samurai swords. She's kick-ass. And Grell, who is the orc avatar of an Australian guy. And the three of them, they love to smack talk each other, but they get really good. And they wonder if, and they enter the world championship of sword and sorcery, and they win it. And oddly, the week I finished that book, it was the first world championship of Fortnite online, with tens of millions of people watching it. And one guy won $1 million. So they win the World Series of Sword and Sorcery. The next thing he knows, our hero, whose avatar is a heroic young battle mage named Dax, with two X's. The next thing he knows, he's standing in a field in the middle of nowhere in scuffed boots. He'd been wearing slippers, and he's got a sword, and a crappy sword, and a little round shield. And he's what? And he's holding a helmet. It's not his headset. And in its curved surface, he can see. It's Dax looking back at him. He's become his own avatar for real. And then he can hear wolves howling. Get out of there. So he's got to survive in order to find out what happened to him and why. And even if the other two are there, there's no sign of them. He might be all alone in this strange new world. So, and then things immediately get worse. He's captured by two wiry little woodskin and marched off to be sold at auction as an outlaw. and the hilarious, yeah. And then, but because of that, he gets into the My Lord's army, where he's trained up by the fearsome Sergeant at Arms Jack Blunt, known to one and all as Sergeant Bastard, who's a master with every weapon and no one can get near him. So they get good. By that time, he's reunited with Grell, who becomes a fearsome with a battle axe as anyone's ever seen. Still no sign of Krista. Where the hell she is, they don't know. But anyway, so that's basically reflects what happens in the game. You find the world, then you train, then you get better, then you level up, as we call it. And then eventually, after about 10 chapters or so, the quest reveals itself to them, and they desert the army with Esmeralda, the 16-year-old daughter of the local lord, who had a blessing laid on her at her birth, which is also a burden. The loveliest life there ever was or ever will be. And she's basically my riff on a fairy tale princess, and she's very got a sharp tongue on her, doesn't mind. she's great, and everyone of course falls mad in love with her, with Esmeralda, and their job is actually twinned with her her quest to find her mysterious godmother, and they go to help her, and it turns out to be wildly different from anything that she could have imagined, and at the end of it all is the explanation for why they're in this world and what's going on. And we're set up to rock and roll for the next three books.
So this is coming out December 12th or December 19th, Richard?
December 12th is the published book, available online in Amazon.co and co.uk and .com and in English bookstores and American bookstores. It's an American publishing company. So Mommy is spelled M-O-M-M-Y because... M-U-M-M-Y is, to an American, an old fossil you find sleeping in the House of Lords.
Well, we say mommy here too in Canada.
Oh, you do? Yeah, well, exactly. Well, so, it's an American book. It's coming out. We're having a big party the night before in London, which should be a hoot. Please check it out. Go to richardsparks.com, download the free audio chapter, or you can listen to it online. Download the free chapter, which is another quite amusing chapter. Heavy on the orcs, the free download chapter. But I love my orcs. They're just great characters. They really don't. They're no nonsense, down to earth, fun people. But they carry warhammers, so be careful.
Well, Richard, it was a blast having you on Tea Time. You know, I learned so much from my guests, and I love to hear the little nuggets and keys that put productions together and all the incredible shows and all the actors out there. I really appreciate you giving a shout out to all those incredible people, because without all of those people, the production doesn't get done, right? So,
well, I was lucky enough to be in the same room, actually the Beverly Hills Playhouse, when Charles Aznavour turned up. And out of the blue, and just sat there and talked to us. And he said, someone asked him about his influences, and he said, we're all products of the others. It is impossible for anyone to emerge fully formed from the forest. And I completely agree. All the people who I've worked with and have taught me so much have been the fertilizer for my own imagination, my own work. I couldn't have done it without them.
And that's how I feel about my Tea Time guests. You guys all fertilize me. You all fill my pot with different flavors, different blends. Some put a little bit more butter. Some put some sugar. Some put cream, you know.
I put honey in my tea. Milk and honey. That's what I use. No sugar.
That's good. Yeah. That's good tea. Yeah. So, Richard, any final words for the listeners out there before we wrap up your Tea Time?
No. If you want to write. You know, Philip Pullman said, writer's block is for amateurs and inspiration is for amateurs. Just you promise yourself you do 500 pages a day, just sit down and do them. 500 words a day, excuse me. But here's the thing. You can write those 500 words, I've discovered. And if they're terrible, you can just throw them away the next day. Just don't worry about it. Don't stress out and just write them. And if you don't get anywhere, so you might have found a little thread. You might know where you should go instead. And Isabel Allende, as I told you, a great friend and a great hero of mine, sold, 60-70 million books. She gets up every morning at 6 o'clock, puts on her makeup, sits down and starts writing. She was interviewed the other day and saying, why? And she said, I just love it. I love writing. If you love writing, write.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you, Richard, and I want to thank all the listeners out there and all the subscribers for Miss Liz's Tea Time. Without all of you guys, I could not do this. So again, I will see everybody for the last show of this week, and then we'll be jumping into December, and then we'll be doing the huge reunion show on December 21st, where a lot of guests are coming back from season 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you'll get to meet all of them and ask all your questions then. But I will be back at 7 p.m. and we will be having a trigger warning for the last show. We are doing a real life murder case, and we have an author who shared the story. So I will respect your wishes if you can't tune in. But Richard, thank you so much for joining me and sharing so many amazing nuggets with me today. I appreciate it. And our journey has just begun. So,
well, maybe I'll see you next year for the sequel when when New Rock, New Realm is released.
Absolutely. And I love it. Like I said, there's a new jingle coming. I can hear the jingle coming in New Rock, New Roll. So until then, I will see everybody at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the last Tea Time of this week.
Thank you for having me.